it's kind of a bunch of us got sober together. We went through this hospital program, and then the lady started going to Al-Anon, and we were all going to AA, and we used to hang out and mess around and stuff, and we joke about being put, the alcoholics would joke about being put in the release zone. And that's where the Al-Anon finally lets the alcoholic go and begin living his own life instead of living his life for him. And then the Al-Anon gets to turn around and live her life for herself instead of living the alcoholic's life for him. And that's a really spiritual, strong thing when you think about it. I mean, what a turning point for both of our lives. And that just that little thing that we used to joke about is so very, very important. Saved countless lives. And I'm really grateful for the Al-Anon program for showing me that and letting me experience that with you guys. Even though I don't particularly still like it, but time to grow up again. Anyway, geez. You know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. You know, I thought I just was messed up, and it was just getting worse as time went on, little by little. Everything just started getting worse and worse, and I stopped and looked back at it. And I couldn't look back at it till I first got sober. My life up till then was just one thing after another that seemed to always turn out really crappy. So I started blaming everything around me for all my shortcomings and character defects that, wreck relationships and just about everything around you, ruins your attitude too. And, that's not a neat way to live at all. But I didn't know anyway what to do until I found a drink. And then I found this drink, and it, you know, I was looking back the other day about what was going on with me, and I was uncomfortable in just about any situation. You know, even if it wasn't stressful or something, I was just like uncomfortable. But when I finally found alcohol, it took all that pressure off. And I thought, well, this is pretty good, you know. And I didn't know it was going to be such a hard road, but, it really worked, you know, when it worked, but it stops working. And that's and then you're really in a hard place. Everyone who's an alcoholic in recovery knows that one. I was raised in a large Catholic family. I'm one of nine children. I have six sisters and two brothers. They're not all living now, but there we were as a group, and we went to Catholic school, did all that. I got introduced to the Nuns of Love, as I refer to them. It's, I don't know. But at the same time, being in Catholic school, I got in touch with a higher power way, way, way back then, even as a young, I think first grade or something. I just remember when they talked about God, how God loves you, and you know, things should be great, you know, for all that stuff, that that things were okay. And I really liked the feeling, the connection I got with the higher power, you know, at that time. You know, we just called him God. And I remember that, but then it kind of drifted away because there's all kinds of other distractions, things going on. And it's like, as it ended up, there's too many rules for me to follow. And I was always, you know, going to hell, you know, four or five times a day, and then back to heaven, just depending on what kind of prayer you said or what you came up with. And that was really stressful. It was really hard to live because I bought into all that, you know, full big, you know, very dangerously naive in some areas, but that's what was going on with me. So I had to put that aside and just go on, you know, went through grade school and high school. We moved to from Los Angeles. We used to live on 60th and Crenshaw in LA there, and we moved down to the beach in the 1950s and went to school there. Then I started going to high school with Sarah and Gardena, and started surfing right in there too, which was really neat. Enjoyed that. And that is where I ran to. Hello. Anyway, started surfing. I really enjoyed that, and that's when I started drinking a little bit. I was thinking back the other day about, you know, what had gone on. The first time alcohol really worked for me, it was on the day that President Kennedy was killed. And we'd gotten out of school, we were down on the beach, and we were hanging out in this guy's house, and I remember having a wine cooler. And about halfway through the first wine cooler, I just felt really, really comfortable with everything. And I thought, God, this is nice. You know, this is really, I didn't think, oh, I'm going to drink the rest of my life. Just thought, this was nice. I felt comfortable. And so I kind of, that's where it started for me, you know, because I really liked the release that I felt. And started drinking, you know, and just messing around, no big deal. I, you know, wasn't like I drank and went to school or anything like that. I just, when we get together, we'd have beers on the weekend and stuff like that. It wasn't any big, you know, have to do this instant stuff with me right away. But it got there, you know, it sure as heck got there. Well, thank you. You know, life kind of went on. I used to do construction work. My dad was a general contractor, and so I could, you know, work for him, you know, and then when summer came around, because I like to surf, my MO was to, you know, work during the winter, and then when summer came around, I would, you know, make myself unemployed miraculously and go collect unemployment during the summer so I could surf, you know, and I really like doing that. And that works pretty good, you know, like when you're like 18, 19, 20. But when you're like in your 30s and married and have a wife and two children, that's not really a really going high spot in our, and you're married, you know. But that's what I was doing. I had this bohemian lifestyle. I had to always, you know, my way, you know, all that crap that gets you in all kinds of holes. But I always blame the holes on someone else, you know. So that made it a little easier to deal with the whole thing. I'm kind of up in the air today. Just a lot of stuff been going on late with me, a lot of different kind of changes and things going on. And it's okay, though. You know, I just, I'm kind of rearranging a lot of things mentally and spiritually because some things that are going on, and that's okay. You know, I just feel a little bit, I don't feel at odds. I just feel a little bit different, probably because I changed, you know, in the last month or so. And that's due to this program that I was able to stick around for the changes, and I'm grateful for that. You know, what's going on with me lately is I just really think that it dawns on me how important our higher power is in my life. I mean, in a lot of new ways. You know, I've been, since I first, you know, I went through my, I'll just go back and go through the drinking part so I can get to AA and make a little more sense of this for you. But, you know, when I drank, you know, in my teenage years, and then I picked up some girl hitchhiking and we started going out. I had a motorcycle and we went out and, you know, eventually somehow she got pregnant, and then her dad said, well, you can either go in the army or you can stay home. And I was such an unselfish guy. I thought, well, I can stay home and have sex with this really good looking lady, or I can go in the army. Gee, let me think about that, you know, cause I'm not shallow or anything. anyway, so we got married and we had no real, we shouldn't have been married. But anyway, that's what happened. And then when that all fell apart, I just used that as drinking material for a long time, and I didn't look at that either till I got sober. Then I saw what I was doing, you know, with that thing, you know, oh, singing the blues, poor me, you know. If she'd offered to let me take the baby, I wouldn't have wanted it, and I couldn't take care of myself, let alone a child, you know what I mean. But I still went there, and oh, well, you know, they're doing it to me again. Anyway, and it went on from there. Went and I was getting, my alcoholism was progressing pretty good then. I was into the hard liquor when I was 17. In the South Bay, a lot of drugs came through, and I took the drugs just like I did alcohol, never gave it a second thought. You know, we just did it because it was there. So alcohol and drugs, and you do that all the time, and you tend to not to, well, at least I didn't find it real conducive to work, you know, because you got to be busy being high, and work kind of gets in the way, you know. So guess which went. Anyway, so that's pretty flaky, but I still would work, and then, you know, get along with things there. A few years went by, and went to Alaska for a little while, lived up there with my sister Cecilia in Ketchikan, and that was fun. I got introduced to Everclear up there. That's 109 group drinking alcohol. That does it pretty quick. It used to drink with Nesbitt's orange juice. You know, it made you a little hoarse, but it warmed you up really quick. Anyway, I got back to Alaska. I was at my parents' house again, and every so often I get this kind of feeling like there was something better for me to be doing or something different. And that's why I went to Alaska the first time. And then a friend of mine lived down at Point Loma, and he was hanging drywall down there at that La Costa place. So I went down to stay with him for a little while. And what he used to do on the weekends was go to Tijuana. You know, he had a girlfriend at one of those really neat bars down there. You know, it's a real lovely situation again. And so we were doing that, going back and forth. Then we decided to make a real career move. We decided to go down and live in Mexico. So I rented a house down in Tijuana by the Bullring by the sea. And that didn't work out so well. I mean, I'm already incoherent around people speaking English, and I go down where they speak Spanish, and I don't, you know, other than más cerveza, you know, all the really important words. Anyway, so that got all screwed up. What was going on? Some of my friends were dying from this, what I know now is this disease. At the time, I looked at it as God's doing it to them. Look at this crap. You know, people started overdose, and a friend of mine who I really liked a lot had split up with his wife and was living next door to them. And I guess he wanted to commit suicide, so he turned on all the pilots in his apartment. And he fell asleep and forgot he'd left them on. He got up in the morning and lit a cigarette and blew the apartment building apart. Didn't kill him right away. He just walked out and was just fried. But his kidneys let go, and he died. So he's like 20, 25, you know. And my ex-wife's sister overdosed too. She died. It just was, and I was just, you know, I was doing this, man, as far as I saw things were going on. But right in that time, I'd have spurts where I'd come out of that and go back and try and do things in a better way. And in one of those good periods, I was home at my parents' house. My brother says, oh, my girlfriend has a friend of hers that would like to go out on a date. And I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. And I went on a blind date, and that's where I met Larcene. And she was special right away. Right away. I still remember her first time I saw her. You know, it was really cool. She says that I didn't fall in love with her really, but I keep telling her that was it for me. I can tell you. And it still is. Best thing that happened. Anyway, so we went on our date and had a really good time. You know, I enjoyed it. We had a good time. I really liked her. We started dating from then on. But then some strange thing happened again. Somehow she got pregnant. And nobody said we had to get married, but we had a little son. And we got married when he was a couple months old, because I wasn't going to do like you're supposed to do, you know. I'm not going to follow those rules and get married before the baby's born. Oh, no. You know, so 2 months after our son was born, we got married. And that's where the, I like to say, our little war started. But she'll give you a different version of that one. But up until then, it was okay, all the stuff I was doing, you know. But seems like when you get married and have a child, you're supposed to have something called responsibility and, you know, take care of business. And I would do that occasionally and then kill it. Do it occasionally and kill it. It's that repetition they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, how we build things up and then tear it down to nothing. And I didn't know, you know, that was an alcoholic pattern. I thought that's just the way life is, and it's not getting any better, you know. And we were married about 6 years before I got sober. But in that six-year period, you know, things would get pretty bad, you know, needless to say. There's a period there about 4 years into marriage when she said, oh, I've talked to a doctor and they have the stuff you can take. Even though I said alcohol wasn't the problem, it's called Anabuse. You can take this and then you won't have to drink and, you know, things will be different. And that's true. I stopped drinking and started taking Anabuse. And then an alcoholic should not stop drinking unless he has a program of some kind. And I didn't have one. So we had 2 years of not drinking. Oh boy, this is just swell. But I was doing my best, you know what I mean, to try and make it work. And what I ended up doing is just getting really sloppy behind drugs every so often. You know, so that was like a giant mess anyway. And that went on for a while. And then we went to the doctor and he says, oh, you know, you aren't supposed to take this forever, you know. And since I didn't have a real problem with alcohol, I figured, well, that's fine. He said, you can go ahead and try some social drinking. And I heard the drinking. For sure. I never heard social drinking before, but I heard the word drinking in there and the bell went off and I started drinking again. And, when I got to AA, they talked about this disease being progressive. I've lived that and I understand what they were saying when I first heard it, because, when I started back to my drinking again, after that 2 years of not having a drink, it took very, very little to get me in a blackout. I just did hardly anything and I would black out. And my reaction to it was just really strong. And it was just that, and that started my last 9 months of drinking. It was pretty much a blackout for me. I'd either wake up, open my eyes and have a drink in my hand and drink it, or I'd do that, wake up, not have a drink and walk off and get it. You know, and I'm living in the house with my wife and two children. You know, they're 2 and 5 and 3 years old. at the time. Not very good. And I thought I was going to work and I wasn't working. I mean, I was just out there. I was gone. And of course I remember one night coming out of a blackout, and I didn't know what blackouts were either. I mean, you know, when you lose a few days, who the hell do you talk to about that? You know, oh yeah, I just lost a few days. And nobody. So what I did, you just drink and pour it in so it doesn't hurt so much, and you don't want to talk about it, you got to hide it. And I didn't know it was part of the disease of alcoholism, a result of drinking. It was just another screwed up thing was going on. I knew I was crazy, and I knew I was just getting crazier. And the rope was getting narrower, so to speak. Anyway, when you're in that kind of condition, you have to drink and drive. And this one particular evening, I remember coming out of a blackout. I'm standing in the living room with Larsine. I remember Larsine looking at me, and I'm laughing hysterically. I feel it laughing. It's almost like I was watching myself. I was laughing hysterically, and then like that, started cussing, screaming, and ranting and raving, and then bang, into a blackout. And we're in that kind of condition. Of course, you have to drive to the bar. And so I'm at the bar, and I got arrested for drunk driving that night. And that's where my life started to change. I came out of the blackout in the police station, and I heard this voice. It could have very well been the policeman next to me, but that's not how I heard it. I heard it as a voice over here, and it had nothing to do with the human being saying anything, because anything another person said to me was automatically rejected as a lie and crap. You know, that's the way I was looking at everything. But I heard this calm voice say to stop fighting. And when I heard that, I recognized that I had been resisting something. I didn't know what it was, but I agreed with it that I had been fighting things I should stop. That, whatever it was. And I blew out, went back into my blackout. And, you know, I didn't know what really happened at the time, but since I've been in AA and learned about the disease and things that go on, you know, my obsession to drink was removed. I haven't won or had a drink since that night, but I didn't know that's what was going to happen. You know, I just know when I woke up in the drunk tank in the morning, I felt different. You know, I didn't feel elated. You know, I was just flat. I just was flat. I didn't say, oh, I'm never going to drink again, or talk to her about what happened. And I even forgot about that for a while, the whole thing that went on, because I was too out there. Anyway, I came home and I went upstairs for a few days and slept. Came downstairs and made that masterpiece, master understatement of the year. I think I got a problem. Oh, no kidding. Anyway, she said, I got the name of the number of this hospital. And she handed it to me. You know, she'd already released me, but thank God, because that started my recovery, and hers eventually too. So I called the hospital and went in there, and I still wouldn't say I was an alcoholic. Life was just screwed up because I didn't know what alcoholism was. But anyway, I went to spent 2 weeks in the psychiatric ward, and that was really an excursion there. They put me in there for 2 weeks to get in touch with my feelings, whatever the hell that was. You know, I thought, well, I'm either angry or I'm happy, so what's there to talk about? That's how deep I went with it all. Anyway, so I wander around there for a little while, and has anyone ever been to a Friday night dance on a psych ward? Any hands? Okay, well, that's a real excursion when you're getting sober. Yeah, well, I tell you, that was pretty weird. They get the other guys like the alkies, and different people aren't too volatile in there. And then there's a bunch of poor ladies that are so full of Thorazine, they just sip hot coffee all the time and spill it on. It's really sad. And then they have a bunch of kids in lockout that are all jacked up on Ritalin. And they open the door, let the kids out, and then turn the music on. And that's Friday Night Dance at the psych ward. I was going, Jesus, what is this not drinking thing, man? This is going to be really weird. But, you know, it had its place. And, it, you know, anyway, moving on from there. The end of my second week there, this lady, they said there's a lady out there in the hall I want you to talk to. And her name was Betsy. And she was one of the counselors from the alcoholism side. And I didn't know, you know, what. But I went down and talked to her, and we started doing the 20 questions, you know. And it's, oh, have you ever lost time from work on account of drinking? And I started, well, you know, not really. And she just looked at me, and I looked at her, and we started laughing about it. You know, she, we were laughing about the BS I was trying to handle her. And I knew something had changed because I never thought anything was funny about my drinking remotely. You know, it was always just a big, we don't talk about that. But went through the whole 20 questions. I still tried to lie my way through and we still laughed at all of them. And I thought, well, this is a neat lady here. She doesn't give me any crap or nothing. She just accepts me the way I am. And I thought, this is nice. And then that after following day, I think I started in the alcoholism side of it. Of the unit, and it was me. Fit me like a glove. You guys started, people in AA started talking about how they drank before they got here, how they looked at life, the stuff they did, things they went through, and what they were doing now to not have to do that anymore. And they weren't doing that anymore. And they were happy and seemed to be pleased with their lives. And I'd never seen that before. You know, so I just right away said, okay, sign me up. You know, this is what I need. You know, it scared the hell out of me. But at the same time, it was just great to hear the news that I had a disease called alcoholism. And that's what had been going on with me. And I had a way to change it through the steps, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could change all that crap around so I don't have to do that anymore. And I've done my best to not to do that anymore. And because this program and the people in it, you know, and I'm really grateful for that. It's been a really, really, really good life and better than I think I deserve, actually. But maybe I do deserve it. What the hell? I'm one of God's kids. He loves us. soon after I got out of the hospital, and they always talked about, you know, the higher power. And I remember they had this prayer they called the Serenity Prayer. And I remembered how tense I was feeling, you know. And so I just said Serenity Prayer as I went along. And it always relieved, always knocked it down. The tension I had always knocked it down. So I was getting results from prayer right off the bat, you know, and I thought, this is kind of neat. And then one day I went in the classroom and sat down, and it really blew my mind. Everything was okay. It was like, it's all right to sit here. Everyone in the room is fine. It was like everything was calm and comfortable, and it just blew me away. You know, I talked to one of the counselors about it a little bit, said, geez, this was really, today was really a special day because da, da, da. Because, yeah, it happens, you know, it's part of being sober. So the next day, being alcoholic, of course, I came back and sat in the same chair, expecting the same results. But it didn't happen exactly that way. But at least I had that moment that I saw that I could be comfortable. And that's because I hadn't been drinking and trying as hard, you know, as much as I didn't know about this program, just being willing to do it. And I was already getting results, you know, with it. When I got out of the hospital, one thing that kind of threw me, before I got out of the hospital, they let me go home for a day? Mm-hmm. A day and visit with Larsine and the kids. You know, and I was there for a while, walking around, and then I was looking at them, and it blew my mind. I said, I don't know these people. You know, it's my wife and my kids, but I really don't know them. You know, and the thing was, what I was driving towards was that I don't know myself, actually. They're just fine. They've always been just fine. I have to go learn about myself. And so I went back to the hospital with that in mind, and I've been working on that ever since. You know, rather than blaming them for me being uncomfortable, you know, this program has shown me that I take responsibility for my feelings rather than blaming somebody else for what I can't absorb or understand. You know, I'm really grateful for that. Anyway, I was out of the hospital maybe a week or two. I used to go up and, you know, read the steps and do that, think about them, meditate some. And I was doing the third step, you know, where you turn your will and your life over the care of God as you understand them. And I found myself mentally going, okay, turn my will and my life over to God. And I'd kind of do this mentally. And then I found myself, like, jumping back really fast. And I thought, well, that's not very good. That afternoon, it dawned on me that wasn't going to work. So I just stopped and I said, God, I need you in my life because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous now, and I need you in my life so I can stay sober and not have to drink again. And I don't think this is going to work if I'm afraid of you all the time. So could you help me not be afraid of you? You know, I didn't get a voice or nothing, but it was the first time I was able to talk on a one-on-one basis with what I call my higher power and have it be all right. You know, I didn't do something wrong, or I wasn't being a blasphemer because I'm trying to talk to God or any of that crap. It just was okay. And it has just grown since then by as much effort as I want to put into it. you know, and it's been a real lifesaver for me and my family and everyone that knows me, because I'm a little more mellow than I used to be, and that's a good thing, you know. It just was really just really a nice start. You know, I didn't come to this program to try and get something. You know, I didn't even know I was alcoholic. I just knew something had to change in my life. You know, I didn't know that I could enjoy life. I never had before, except when I was drunk, but that got less and less. So I didn't know what to look for or what to expect. I've never worked the steps with any expectations either. I just work them because they say you work the steps and you get results. I never said, well, I need this result and that result. No, I've never done that. You know, I just look at it as you work this step and it will improve you somehow. You'll grow somehow, and that's its reward, you know, and it's worked really well for me. You know, I've been sober since 1979. July of 79 is when I got sober, and it's been working on a daily basis since then, you know, regardless of things that I've had to go through or not go through. You know, it's been such a wonderful program, you know. You know, the Al-Anon program is just amazing to me. You know, I've been around it since I first got sober. We used to hang out at, go to Christmas parties over at her first sponsor's house, Carol Thornton, and that was a lot of fun. And you see all kinds of people there. I met, you know, the one guy who bought Dr. There I go. I can never remember anyone's damn name. But it was the doctor who wrote the thing about acceptance in the Big Book. He would be at the party and meet him, meet Scott Redmond and Clancy and all these people, you know. It's kind of cool. Frank Priest, a bunch of guys that have been around for a long time. And they were great parties, and you got to be exposed to some really good sobriety. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that, you know. And that and Dick was my sponsor for a while until he passed away. He was a really good man. Really enjoyed that. You know, but I don't know, having been around the Al-Anon program, around people in Al-Anon, working program, it's as big a miracle as Alcoholics Anonymous is on any given day, you know, and it's just as important. You know, we always say, oh, the alcoholic will drink himself to death, but yeah, the poor Al-Anon people will get crazy or wherever it goes, take some, or homicidal or suicidal, and that's just as devastating as drinking yourself to death, I'm concerned. It's just so beautiful to see a program that is so freely given like Alcoholics Anonymous is to help people that we affect so badly with our drinking. You know, all they do is love us, and we just destroy them. I do our best to destroy it when we're doing our disease. And this Al-Anon program, I've seen help ladies going through drinking, you know, drinking situations with their husband. They still work this program. They still have a good life. You know, I find that as a miracle. You know, and it's really a good thing, you know, in my opinion. Nothing wrong with that in the least. I don't know, hard what else to say. I just, we've gone through some health stuff lately. I just had diagnosed with cancer in June, and we did the radiation, all that stuff. So I think I'm coming out of it okay. It's still, blood test was okay, and we're doing another, I don't talk too much about the health stuff, but anyway, things are getting better. And I got some acceptance with the whole situation by keeping in touch with my higher power and talking to people on the program who've been through similar things, and all the support and prayers I've gotten from everybody. It's just fantastic. It's prayer works, you know, and that's a good thing. Just to know that you're, people care enough about you to put you in their thoughts and prayers is a positive thing. You know, I go to I used to go to a men's stag all the time, but now we do it on this stuff here, but I really miss not going there, you know, and we had to finally get a name for our meeting too. It's been around for, I guess, a good 30 years, actually longer than that, but anyway, I'm not sure how long, but we got our name as the Baja Men's Stag. And that what that stands for is Beyond All Human Aid. That's the name we came up with, because that's what we're about. And we know it. And it's a really nice meeting. What we do is we read a page or a paragraph out of the Big Book, and we talk about that and that only. You know, so it's always focused on recovery. And a lot of people really like that. I really like that. You know, and there's a timer. Everyone gets to share. It's really a good meeting. It's helped me a lot. I could probably be quiet now, let my wife start to talk and tell you the real story. But I want to thank all you guys for being here. And I'm glad you're all in Al-Anon. And if you aren't in Al-Anon, I'm glad you're in AA. And if you aren't in either, I'm glad you're alive and you're here and you haven't got a shot to do whatever you need to do. Just thank you so much. I want to thank you guys for giving my life back. Bye-bye.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And like Jack said, doing this Zoom thing is hard. But I tell you what's really hard is sitting next to your spouse and not being able to say anything while he's speaking. Okay, because that was like, it took every bit of 39 years in Al-Anon for me to not say, well, nope, that's wrong. Nope, they got that in the right order. So I'm exhausted, okay? I need to go to bed right now. I am tired.
Released.
But anyway, I want to thank Jack and Willie so much for the invitation to get to share this very, very, very special anniversary. I mean, the 7 o'clock, you know, Let's Rock Men's group is it's famous among the women, okay? That's how famous your group is. And, you know, and what you guys do, you know, is a phenomenal, wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's just really cool because I always think about, you know, I think it's your 29th anniversary, you know, and I think about Willie and Pat and those guys, you know, and coming and then, but the people, they keep coming. So the 29 years later, I know you had a new guy here, that there's a meeting here for him to come to. And it's a good meeting because it's a meeting about Al-Anon. It's a meeting about working the 12 steps. It's a meeting about what we do for ourselves. And, you know, and the recovery that one person gets, you know, that little piece of just that peace of mind for just even a fraction of a second, you know, I mean, once you get a taste of that, it's hard not to want to come back for more. So anyway, and happy birthday to all the birthday people. I think anniversaries are phenomenal. I mean, they are just, you know, it's just a real testament to you heard something, you know, and it's a real testament that not only did you hear something, but you keep coming back and you're there to pass that on to the next person that needs to hear it. So, again, congratulations to all of the birthday guys as well. I want to thank my husband for sharing with me tonight.
You're welcome.
It's just always blows my mind every time we get to share together because it's like never in my wildest dreams did I ever think, you know, that we would be in this position, you know, that we would be, you know, celebrating recovery together, you know, that I would have my own program. I mean, you know, even when I came to Al-Anon, I wasn't looking for my own program. You know, I was looking to enhance his program, okay, because he needed enhancing. And, you know, he just has always needed my help. You know, like he always jokes about that first date, you know, and oh, how he was in love with me right away. What crapola. I was freaking 17. He was 24. He was just looking for nothing other than getting my pants, okay? Let's just know, you know. But of course, he turns it into romance and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And as he told you, he did, because I ended up getting pregnant a couple years later. But, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home with an alcoholic dad who was just this really, really mean guy. And I say he was a mean guy because my dad was a mean drunk. I mean, he just was one of those not happy drunks. You know, I remember here in the beginning when I would go to AA meetings and they would talk, you know, about having that first drink and, you know, whatever it was into that, you know, halfway into the second drink, you know, that ease, that sense of ease and comfort would come over them, you know, and I don't know that I ever saw my dad have a sense of ease and comfort anywhere into it. You know, it's just not any recollection that I have. I don't doubt that that doesn't happen. I just never saw that happen in my dad, you know, and where that all came from him and what all the violence and the anger was about. It was his reaction to the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, and all I knew is that I couldn't wait to get the heck out of that house. I hated that house. You could cut the hate in my house with a knife. I mean, it was just, you know, my mother despised my dad, and I don't know that my dad despised my mom so much because he was just this mean drunk guy, and he just believed that we were his possessions, and he acted like we were his possessions. He could do with us what he wanted. You know, he made us. He could take us out. He could make another one just like us. You know, he was just a very violent, angry, angry man, and I couldn't wait to get out of there, and so when I met Butch, you know, number one on my list of, you know, getting out of that house was, boy, I couldn't wait. I was going to meet somebody who I was going to love with all my heart, who was going to love me with all of their heart. And we were going to have nothing but girl children because my dad very much disliked having daughters. And, you know, we were going to have 7 or 8 girls and, you know, and he wasn't going to drink because I knew at 17, you know, drinking was the reason that our life was the piece of absolute crap that it was. And I wasn't going to have that. And yet I go out on this date with Butch and, you know, and like he says, you know, we had a great time, but he doesn't tell you, you know, that on the way back to his house where we were going to play this game, he stops at a liquor store and he asks me what I would like to drink. Now, I was 17 years old, you know, and I tell you what I know at 17. Keep your nose clean. Obey the rules. Do what the Sarge tells you to do or you're going to get the crap beat out of you. So I am a good girl and I do not violate these rules. So when Butch asked me what I'd like to drink, well, then I proceed to tell him, you know, the laws of the state of California, because apparently he does not understand the drinking laws, which I think you can never violate under any circumstances whatsoever. You know, and I am an underage minor, buddy. And, you know, and I know he heard even today what he, when he doesn't want to hear what I'm telling him, he hears blah, 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 you know, and he says, I didn't tell him when he just doesn't want to hear it. You know, that's still, even with 41 years of sobriety, he hears what he wants to hear when he wants to hear it. And so anyway, but he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me with his wine knowledge. What do I know? You know, I don't know crap about wine. And we went back to his house with this other couple and we played this game. It's called Pass Out. Don't care if you, you know, if you've heard of it or not, it's a legitimate board game. You can still get it on eBay. And it's a drinking game. You know, and now there's another rule that's in my life that's even more important than the not drinking rule, and I must win every game I play, okay? That's just, you know, again, how I was raised. You know, my dad was a master sergeant in the Army. My dad was a World War II veteran. My dad was a Korean War veteran. We do not surrender. You know, you use any tactics you can to win. There is no fair war, you know? So, and I mean, and the rule in my, don't come home if you're a loser. You know, you come home victorious, and, you know, you win, you know, which, you know, in a way, sometimes I think that has stead me, you know, well, but let me tell you, when you're a grandmother and you're trying to kick the crap out of your 3-year-old granddaughter, it shoots them ladders. I mean, it's just, it becomes a big character defect in a hurry. All right. So, I mean, I find myself getting all tense because I'm losing chutes and ladders to a 3-year-old. So anyway, work still in progress, always still in progress, but a little while ago, but anyway, like Butch said, you know, but again, the, you know, this is kind of where I will stand toe-to-toe with any alcoholic, you know, in rationalization and justification. Because then I go out on this date with Butch and, you know, and I drank a little bit of this wine. I won the game. That's what that was all about. You know, and guess who drank the rest of the wine, you know. So he's pretty drunk. There is no doubt about it. Our very first date, you know, number one violation, no drinking on the guy, you know, that I want. But I tell you, what I still remember from that day to this, too, is what a great time I had. I had never laughed so hard in my life, never felt so comfortable with somebody. It was a wonderful thing, you know, and this is like where I say, you know, I will rationalize and justify my behavior because number one on my list is, you know, no drinking. And now I've gone out with this guy. I can't wait to go out with him again, you know, and he's violated the number one no drinking rule. But again, you know, I always call it information from nowhere, you know, because this is just where I just think crap up, you know, because I think crap up all the time to justify what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, you know. And it's like we say in Al-Anon, you know, would you rather be right, you know, or would you rather be happy, you know? Well, why would you say something that wasn't right in the first place, you know? I mean, I'm just, you know, that's what I'm always thinking. My thinking is always right. If I think it's the right thing to think, because why would I think wrong things? That's not going to get you anywhere, you know. And I tell you all this so you know what a mess I was when my sponsor got me and had to work with. It was not an easy chore, but what I decided with Butch is, yeah, he's drinking, but see, when my dad's drinking and my dad gets drunk, my dad wants to hit you and yell at you and make you feel bad about who you are. You know, when Butch was drinking, he just wanted to hug me and kiss me and tell me how pretty I was. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that's stuff I can work with, okay? Because that has the potential that only we can ever see in the alcoholic. You know, if they would only just do what we told them, everything would be fine. But, of course, that's not going to happen. And, you know, and Butch and I started dating exclusively from that point on. And, you know, and he was always drinking and he was always doing a lot of drugs. And I share this with you because he never hid it from me. He never acted like it wasn't, you know, a big part of his life. this is what I do. You can like it or you can not like it. I mean, he's always been that part of him. I mean, that's an honest part of him. That's just always, this is what you get. You know, he never tried to hide it from me or pretend he wasn't doing stuff he wasn't doing. You know, he was just out there. And I share this with you because, you know, years later, when our life got really, really bad behind my husband's, you know, drinking and using and stuff. And when I came into Al-Anon, if you would have said, Larsine, did you know he was drinking and doing drugs and all that stuff? I would have said, oh no, I had no idea it was that bad. You know, because that's the lie that the family disease of alcoholism wants to tell me. You know, and growing up in that house with that alcoholic dad, boy, number one skill you learn, or at least I did, is lie. You have to lie. You have to constantly lie and cover up. You know, in my house, it's always about the problem. Who started it? You know, whose fault it is? Who's going to take the blame for it? You know, and when that's what your focus is all the time, lying is just a natural survival thing that just kicks right back in there. And I just took to it great. And I'm not the drinker and I'm not the drug user. And I'm here to tell you, I probably told 1,000 lies to everyone Butch told me during that whole drinking thing that was going on, how I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, and after a few years, you know, I ended up getting pregnant. And again, you know, I don't care if it's a big deal to you, it's a huge deal to me because I'm a rule and regulation person. And this is way out of the line, the outline of how things are supposed to go down. And like my husband said, we didn't end up getting married till a couple of months after our son was born. So if you asked me if I was pregnant when I got married, no, I was not. Because I wasn't pregnant when I got married. The fact that I had a 2-month-old baby is totally up to you to figure out. I am not going to be responsible for your ignorance in my situation. You know, and again, the lies. It all starts with the lies and the lies and the lies, you know. And I want you to know that when Butch and I got married, we definitely got married that because of this child, this was absolutely positively the driving force behind he and I getting married. You know, but I want you to know that Butch and I got married in a church in front of a minister. And he was sober that day, you know, and I left him and I know he left me. And I believe we were as sincere as any two people are when they get married, that we wanted to love each other and cherish each other and honor our vows and do all those things and live happily ever after. You know, but what, you know, he didn't know and what I didn't know was it wasn't just Butch and I that got married that day. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I am here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. And it means to tear your family apart. And it will do so through the alcoholic, you know, but I'm here to testify that it will equally do so through the non-alcoholic member of the family. How I am affected by the disease of alcoholism, what I start doing, you know, the lies I start telling, the things I do to cover up, just all the insanity and all the garbage that goes on along with that. And so, you know, we took off and I remember the day after we got married up into this point, I never said crap to Butch about his drinking or his drug use, nothing. But the day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. Dude, this is how it's going down. Babysitter once a month. You can go out, party once a month, but other than that, you're working, bringing home a paycheck. This is the plan. Do you understand? And I remember him in the kitchen chair doing this, which I took to be affirmative. You know, what I know today is he was so drunk and loaded, his head was just doing the bebop thing. And, you know, and I know that because day 3 of our marriage, he does not come home all night long. Now, this is a huge violation of the rules and regulations that I have sat down, you know, and this wasn't going to happen. You know, and again, you know, I was just like one of those little Pekingese dogs when you walk in the house, just start yelling and screaming and ranting and raving. I mean, I was insane. You know, Butch used to beg for the silent treatment, but I am proud to tell you he never got it, not one time, boy, you know, because I was just, it's craziness. It's absolute insanity. And he even says I talk as fast as I do because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out for me to tell him everything it was that I had to tell him because by God, he was going to hear it, you know. And again, because information from nowhere lands here, you know, like if you yell at him enough, if you curse at him enough, if you cry enough, you know, whatever, you know, that you think will for sure have this major impact. You know, I just figured I'm just going to, because I watched my mom for years say nothing, you know, so I know being quiet didn't work, you know. In reality, my mom didn't say anything because my dad would beat the crap out of her, you know, and I wasn't in that situation, which was never this kind of violent guy, but that's just the stuff that went on. And, you know, and I did all the things I could try to do to fix him. you know, just everything I could possibly think of. And, you know, and always make him raising his hand, always promising me, oh, da-da-da-da, you know, and just all of that crap that went just on and on and on. And, you know, and then, you know, again, several years into the marriage, you know, I went to Al-Anon, maybe 4 or 5 years after we were married. I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting, and they have, you know, great meeting, great literature on the table, but not the piece of literature that I'm interested in, which is how to get him to stop drinking and do what you want him to do. I still think it's a great title. I just say it. I just think it's a great title. It would capture people right away. They'd want that piece of literature. But and then you could put the real stuff inside. But you know, they didn't have that piece. You know, they just have, you know, the stupid stuff. You know, merry-go-round named denial, you know, understanding ourselves. You know, it's like, why? There's nothing wrong with me. You know, you fix him. You know, and I'll tell you, you know, and yet when I was sitting in that front row and they said, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? Oh, my God, do I want my life to be different? Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Nothing, because it's not my fault. Because I grew up in a house. It's whose fault it is. That's the problem. That's all. And again, all my focus, the problem, the problem, the problem. You fix him and I'm going to be okay. You know, and just all that insanity that went on. And I'm not going to go through all the drunk stories and all that kind of stuff because there isn't time for it. But, you know, but it was a roller coaster ride. It was absolutely. And I couldn't understand it. And I couldn't understand it because I loved my husband. And I believe my husband loved me. I really and truly did. I mean, there wasn't a question about that. You know, when he did sober up, he was always very remorseful, always very sorry, always very sorry that he spent an entire paycheck in a night. When I needed baby formula and diapers, you know, we couldn't pay our rent. I had no, you know, I mean, cashing in bottles, you know, so I could buy macaroni and cheese to feed the kids. I mean, I just, you know, what the heck is all this about? And I couldn't understand it. And for whatever reason, you know, again, lack of knowledge is our dilemma, you know, because again, information from nowhere lands here becomes fact for me. Because see, I can drink or not drink. And because I can drink or not drink, that means you can drink or not drink. So then you're drinking at me. And I don't know, when you're drinking at me, you know, and that's just how it looks. You know, thank God I've been to as many AA meetings as I know, because I've probably been to thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have yet to hear one AA person ever share anywhere that he drank or used or she did because they wanted to hurt their family. Never heard it, not one time. But it sure feels like he's drinking at me, you know, because it seems like I'm the one with all the consequences all the time. I'm the one keeping a job. I'm the one keeping a roof over our head. He keeps telling me he's sorry, and then he goes back and does it all over again. You know, one time I was like, I'm done. I'm leaving. I'm out of here with the kids. And he's like, no, no, it's going to be okay. I promise. He goes, I'm not going to drink anymore. We'll just get a babysitter. You know, we'll go out to dinner. We'll talk about it. You know, we get a babysitter, we go out to dinner, we go to this Italian restaurant, and the first thing he does is he orders a carafe of wine. And I'm like, I thought you said you weren't going to drink anymore. And he goes, this is wine. Like, wine doesn't count. I mean, this is why we become sick, too. Because he's so convincing. I'm like, is wine alcohol? I mean, it's just the insanity that happens. And more, you know, I liken living with the disease of alcoholism as having a bowl of crap in front of you. And I don't think there's anybody in this room that'll sit down and eat a bowl of crap in one spoonful of, you know, or a whole bowl at a time. But I'm here to tell you, I'll choke down a teaspoon every single day if it'll just make it be quiet. You know, and this is where unacceptable behavior becomes acceptable behavior. You know, this is where my thinking gets all screwed up because I think it's going to be different, or I think I can do this, or I think I can do that, or I think I can yell at, or I think he's drinking at me, or all of that garbage. And all of that garbage generates in me is nothing but anger. I am just one pissed off woman most of the time. And, you know, and then we were going to have a family reunion, his family reunion. And he's, like you said, he's 1 of 9, only alcoholic out of the bunch. Lucky me. You know, I make him raise his right hand and promise me he'll be sober that day so we can go. And he does, because he means to be. And that day comes, and guess who's so drunk and so loaded we can't go? You know, and I like to tell you, boy, I am livid, livid. You know, and I'm here to tell you, Butch has never raised a hand to hit me because he's not that guy. But that day I was poking him in the chest and I was egging him to hit me. Let's just go here. Let's just take it to the next level. This is how enraged I am. And all of a sudden I become very conscious of our 2 little boys who are like 5 and 3 years old at that point. You know, and I look down and they're yanking at my pant legs and big tears coming down their face. Mommy, mommy, please stop yelling at daddy. And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I did not. What I started doing was I started screaming at those little kids. You know, how dare you tell me to stop yelling at your dad when he's the reason our life is the piece of crap that it is. And by the time I get done yelling at those little kids, I look up at my drunken husband walking out the front door. And I, the sober mom, say to the drunken dad, where do you think you're going? And the drunken father turns to the sober mom and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the kids. And again, I tell you this because I really believe, you know, that, you know, most of the damage inflicted on my family during those years of alcoholism, as our family unit was with my two sons and my husband, was mostly, probably 85% me. Totally justified, totally rationalized in everything I said and did. You know, and I'm here to tell you, my husband's done some, you know, like I said, paychecks and losing trucks and, you know, all that other garbage, you know, that goes along with active alcoholism and the embarrassment and humiliation and that kind of stuff that goes around with being with a drunk person. But I'm here to tell you everything my husband ever did that was wrong, he did drunk and out of his mind on drugs. You know, I'm here to tell you every mean, nasty thing I did stone cold sober, totally rationalizing and justifying my behavior. You know, I've really come to believe that justifiable anger is just as deadly to the Al-Anon as the first drink is to the alcoholic, because it will take me to a dark place. And boy, I am hardwired for the negative thinking. You know, I mean, that's just where I go. Even today, I know to throw that first thought out the window. It is not going to serve me. So anyway, fast forward, you know, Butch ends up getting arrested for drunk driving. He got arrested lots of times for drunk driving, but you just got to know this was in the 70s. Back then, you paid a lawyer $500. Got reduced to reckless, out the door you go. We've been this four or five times, you know. But this time, because he was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, he took the rap for the drunk driving thing, you know, and stuff. And so he got his license suspended, you know, and all that. But he'd gone through this hospital program. You know, they told me I should go to a Al-Anon meeting, you know, and I am like a rule follower. They didn't do any family therapy or nothing. So I go back to the meeting I'd been to before, you know, about a year earlier, and I raised my hand. I said, you know, I was here about a year ago and I asked you how to get my husband sober and you didn't tell me, and I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now. And you know what they said to me? They said, keep coming back. And I am here to tell you, if you're at a meeting and they tell you to keep coming back, it's because you said the most asinine BS crapola in the universe. It's the only thing they can tell you to do until your head pops out of your butt and you can finally hear what's going on at the meeting, you know. And so even though I am getting, you know, it's been 6 months and I'm getting used to the whole Zoom thing, I really miss the sound of being in a meeting and hearing that pop in the back of the room every so often, because it is nothing is better than watching someone get it. You know, finally, it's, you know, and that's what it takes. You know, I mean, at least that's what it took for me. You know, and that was, again, the end of my Al-Anon career. Butch is sober, game over, I win, nanny, nanny. You know, I mean, I wasn't going back. And then real quick, you know, 2 years into my husband's sobriety, I'm very task oriented. You know, there is no fun till the job is done is my motto. You know, I'm not kidding. I am, you know, I am army regimented, and certain tasks, certain days, da 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 da, checklists, clipboards. I love all that stuff. And this particular day was laundry day. And Butch is now in the living room, 2 years sober. He's in the living room with the kids, and they're laughing. I hear him in the other room laughing. You know, and then I come in with my laundry basket, and it's dead silence. And I suck the joy out of the room. I mean, that's just what happens. When I walk in, it's just nobody laugh. And I remember walking through that room, and I heard God's voice in my head as clear as a bell. You know, much like Butch heard his voice, you know, I heard just say, you know, you've become your dad. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt, I would be, that's exactly who I was. I wasn't alcoholic like my dad, but I was running this family with fear and intimidation because I'm so afraid that they're going to slip through my fingers if I don't ride them and I don't control them, you know, that it's all going to slip away from me. And I don't think you get a message like that you don't get an answer, you know. And then the next thing I heard in my head is, this is not who you are supposed to be. And I knew that that was true. You know, so when I started coming to Al-Anon, I started coming not to get an alcoholic or keep him sober. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. See, I really believe that when Butch was sober, when Butch was providing a paycheck, when Butch was a good husband, when Butch was a good father, that all those things would fix him. And 2 years into his sobriety, and he was doing beyond any expectation I had for him, I was as miserable as I'd ever been in my life because I didn't know how to stop being pissed. That's all I know, how I react to everything. And that it's like my friend Crazy Gene used to say, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, I mean, I just had nowhere to go with it. And so, and when you got nowhere to go with it, all you can do is look in the mirror. Why am I doing this over and over again? You know, so, you know, so, and then my first sponsor wasn't Carol. I mean, my first sponsor was Jeannie, you know, and I had Jeannie for the first 9 years until she died of cancer. And then Carol was my sponsor for the next 30 years. And then we just lost Carol this past April. And I miss her very, very, very much. I mean, it's still, such a hard thing for me. But I know, I always joke, you know, it's just as well, you know, she would hate Zoom. Everybody who knows Carol knows she would be pissed about us doing meetings on Zoom. It would be, I would hear about it every single day. So I think God in his infinite wisdom said, Carol, you're coming with me because there's no way you're going to do this. And so I know she's up there watching and taking care of us and watching over us and loving us. And I am so, so grateful. You're so, so grateful for her love. I can't say enough about sponsorship. I can't say enough about coming into a program. You know, like I know that you guys come into this men's stack. You know, it isn't about the alcoholic. As much as we want it to be about the alcoholic, it's not. It's about what you can do for yourself, what you can do to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, that these are the things that get presented to me over and over and have been, you know, by Jeannie first and then Carol. You know, I mean, it's just the stuff that goes on and, you know, and a different way to look at it. You know, in one sentence, if I can tell you what Al-Anon gives me every day is it just gives me the shot at a good life. You know, it lays the 12 steps at my feet, you know, and all these tools, you know, this family and, you know, and dear friends that I've had for so long, you know, Jack among them, you know, I mean, that we pray for each other, we care for each other, and we don't do anything alone. And the best part of it is nobody's trying to fix me. And I don't feel compelled to try and fix you either. It's not my job to do that. It's my job to be your friend and be with you as you go down that path. You know, and hold your hand, you know, because I know it's your journey and you're the one that has to make it, you know, but the big deal is you don't have to do it alone. And I sometimes think that's the hardest part, you know, that's still the most difficult for me is asking for help when I need it, you know, and that, like I say, it's still a thing for me and not having Carol around because, you know, I talked to Carol so frequently, you know, she would just always know that stuff was going on. You know, I had a lot of trouble with my youngest son and so I was fearful for this kid. You know, he'd been in trouble since he was 12, started acid, you know, on the roller coaster ride of all time. And, you know, and I always like to tell this story. Carol always wanted me to tell this story when I spoke. And so to honor her, I always try to remember it. And so Earl, he happens to be, you know, like at this point, 19 years old, having lots of trouble. And I've been in, you know, we've been at the South Bay Roundup this particular weekend. And you know how you, when you've been to a roundup and all your friends and the speakers and serenity's like coming out of every orifice of your body when you get home, you're just so full of it. And so again, I'm very disciplined. I get home on Sunday. I'm very disciplined in my exercise. I go out to the garage where my treadmill is. And next to the treadmill is my son's weight bench. And on this weight bench is a driver's license. It's a woman's driver's license, you know, and it has information. I love information. You know, her address is there. Her birth date's there. She's like 36 years old, whatever, lives in Glendora, California. I instantly decide. Now, mind you, I am, you know, 20-something years in Al-Anon at this point, but I instantly decide to get information from nowhere, lands here, that this woman has been in my house. She has had sex with my 19-year-old son, wants to marry him and call me mom. I am all over this story, okay? She's got two kids, I mean, the whole nine yards. And I run in and I show Butch the driver's license and nothing because the man has no imagination whatsoever. He just thinks it's a stupid driver's license, you know? I'm like, no, it's not, you know? And as I tell him my story, I have made up out of nowhere, because I'm afraid, you know, and that's what I do, boy. I just, you know, because what's the worst that can happen? They can die. And it's happened. I've been to more funerals for kids than I care to tell you, and it's the worst thing in the world. But Butch was like, call Carol, you're wackadoodle, you know, and so I called Carol. And Carol rarely gave me direction, but that day she told me to shut up. And she says, you know what? She goes, you know what, it takes just as much effort for you to pray for that kid as for you to think up more garbage in that head about what you think is going on there. You know, so instead of just thinking up crap on a kid who's already got enough crap on his plate, why don't you just pray for him instead? You know, and I end my conversations as I often did with Carol, never mind, because I've been coming for a long time. I just need to be reminded. And as it turns out, I don't see him for a couple of days because of his drug schedule and my work schedule. And 2 days later, he walks in with the driver's license and he says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? Well, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license, because it's a very, very bad example of somebody who's going to meetings, turning their life over to the care of God, working the steps. You know, and I share this with you because it is. It's one day at a time. You know, how good I was doing this 3 months ago has nothing to do with what I'm doing right here, right now. You know, and I have been well. And I think when I think about Jeannie, who's not here anymore, and I think about Carol, who's not here anymore, they taught me well. They gave me everything they had to give, everything that was given to them and passed on by their sponsors, who include Winnie Eddy and Charlotte, you know, and a lot of other people, wherever that thing goes. And that's what our responsibility is here. You know, I used to say to Carol when I was really, really afraid for Earl, you know, how am I supposed to be happy, joyous, and free when I have a kid that might die from this disease? And she says, because if you're not happy, joyous, and free, you show that kid no hope. And so what I got to learn in all of that was that it wasn't about if he got sober or he didn't get sober. It was about loving him unconditionally, just where he stood, just who he was. And that's where I got my peace from, you know, because we were always current. He knew his mother loved him, and I know he loved me. And I didn't let the nasty disease of alcoholism rob us of that. Unacceptable behavior was unacceptable behavior. I'm not saying anything about that part. But I love that kid unconditionally. Carol made me look up unconditional. And you know what it says? No conditions. It's no loopholes on that stuff. You know what I mean? It's just like, and she was true. There was nothing my kid could do to make me not love him. You know, and he had his roller coaster ride, and I don't have time to go into all his stuff, but at 36 years old, he finally turned himself into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he just recently celebrated this past August 7 years sober in AA, and again, I am so, so grateful. He lives a wonderful life. You know, he's a happy, and I say kid, good God, he's 40-something now, and, you know, still but still, you know, and because of Al-Anon, I can let him live his life and be who he is. And I don't want you to think that my son got sober because, you know, I was working this great program and his dad was working this great program. I'm working the program I'm working, and his dad is working, and all of you guys are working the program you're working. You know, we say, but for the grace of God, I really believe it's but for the acceptance of God's grace. My son just accepted God's grace in his life that day, and it changed for him. And when I accept God's grace in my life, things change for me. You know, and like Butch just said, we recently just went through all this stuff with him having liver cancer. And, you know, just real quick, I mean, liver cancer, I am on it, okay? I have folders. I have hospital appointments. You know, we are getting a liver transplant because that's what they said was the thing to do, so he would never have any kind of reoccurrence. And, you know, and he's already had hep C. He's already got bad cirrhosis. I mean, he has a big history of how we got to liver cancer. And I'm taking him to USC, and we're meeting. This is all through the virus crapola, you know, and all this stuff that we have to do. And then after we spend all day at USC seeing the doctors, doing all the blood work and stuff like that, we get back in the car to come home, and then Butch is like, "Larsine, I'm not going to have a liver transplant." And I'm like, "The hell, you're not going to have a liver transplant, you know?" And it's just like, you know, but he's like, "You know, I'm 73 years old. I've heard everything they have to say. I know what other choices I have, you know, so I'm going to do radiation and blah, 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 blah." And he goes, "And I need you to love me, and I need you to support me through this. I don't need you to make it any harder on me than it already is." You know, and then when your husband starts using Al-Anon back on you, that's just like the kiss of death, pretty much. But you know, it's just the way, you know, that it ended up being. And he makes a big deal because, he would tell me, "It's my liver." And I go, "Well, you know, your liver happens to be attached to my husband. So I think I got a say about it, you know." And again, I can rationalize and justify why it's okay for me to interfere to this day. And those are the things that I have to be really, really super, super careful about. You know, and like you say, all you guys' prayers and your love. And right now he's finished his radiation. His cancer numbers are really low. He goes back for an MRI in a couple of months to make sure those tumors are away. You know, the scary part is they say he has a 60 to 70% chance of reoccurrence. You know, but I look at it like that's terrible, but he's alcoholic. And he looks at it like I have a 30 to 40% chance that it's not coming back. You know, I mean, he's looking at it through those colored glasses, and as he reminds me, for an alcoholic, 30 to 40% is like 150 to normal people. And I have learned, I have been in Al-Anon long enough, do not mess with the alcoholic math, okay? No matter what they are going to do the alcoholic math, you might as well just surrender to it, all right? So that's just kind of where we are and what's going on in our life. And even though all this stuff is going on and blah, 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 you know, I don't know that 2020 won't be the best year, you know, that's happened personally for us. You know, we have a grandson who's afflicted with Friedreich's ataxia, and, you know, he's lost his ability to walk, and he's 17 years old, but he's just started a trial, you know, of this new drug that's supposed to stop the progression, you know, and all this stuff, no matter what's going on, and there's always highs and there's always going to be lows. But because of Zoom and because of the guys at this meeting, like, you know, who Willie was talking about, you know, who go through the effort to make sure, you know, that we can all still get together this way, you know, it doesn't matter. Because even though I can't, you know, see you and necessarily feel your reaction or whatever, I see a lot of faces here and I relate to every face that I'm looking at. You know, and I see your love and I see your compassion and I see your caring and I feel like I am with my people because I am with my people. You know, that's one thing that always attracted me about Al-Anon. I could never put my finger on it. Why did I keep coming back? I hated it. I hated the stupid stuff, the stupid steps, the stupid things we have to do here. But I'll tell you, every time I went to a meeting, I knew there was just something, that the truth is there, and I could not deny it. It took me a long time, but I just couldn't, and that's what keeps you coming back. You know, so keep hearing the truth. Keep loving each other. Keep caring about each other. COVID does not make any of that crap go away. We're just as here for the new people as we ever have been. And I know it's hard to be new here, but boy, we'll get you phoneless. We'll get you hooked up. And then when we all get to meet in person, you'll wish there was Zoom again. Trust me, because we're a wackadoodle group here. So anyway, thank you. Happy anniversary. And thanks for having us.